This is Audible.
Surviving and thriving with an invisible chronic illness. How to stay sane, be your own advocate, and live your best life. By Alana Jacklin. Narrated by Lori Prince. Introduction. Chronic illness is kind of an asshole. It doesn't care if you have things to do. It doesn't care if you can't walk down the aisle on your wedding day. It doesn't care if you have to struggle to sit through your graduation ceremony. It doesn't care if you sleep well, eat well, or if you take your medicine on time. It doesn't care if you've got a big meeting in the morning or a special dinner later tonight. When you're trying to figure out how to live with chronic illness, sometimes you're going to feel like an asshole too. Like when you miss your best friend's birthday party because of it. Or when you hem and haw about buying plane tickets to New York because you just don't know how you'll feel on those days. Or when your dogs or your kids want to play and you just can't. Sometimes it serves a purpose. Like knowing all the best pickup spots for chicken soup. Or always having a spare painkiller, antihistamine, lozenge, sleeping pill in your purse for the friend in need. Or just being the one who constantly makes the whole group take bathroom breaks when one of them has just drunk a 42-ounce Gatorade and doesn't want to be rude. However limiting, binding, time and energy-thieving chronic illness might be, life with it is all about making choices that you control. Take responsibility for it. Recognize that whatever you do right now is going to affect you later. Know that not speaking up and going to the doctor when symptoms strike usually means that they're going to get worse, not better. And realize that not sucking it up and dealing with it on certain occasions can mean the difference between the people around you respecting you or alienating you. You should concede that you are 100% responsible for the planning of your future from here on out. Life with chronic illness is about managing expectations while keeping the hope alive enough to still make plans for the future. It's knowing that there is nothing wrong with wanting when there is still the hope of having. As you move forward into a functional life, what will be your way of making money, meeting career goals, and managing your marriage, family, and friends? And most importantly, your expectations. Me and my invisible chronic illness. Many chronic illnesses are obvious to the naked eye. Assistive devices such as walkers, wheelchairs, tubes, monitors, oxygen tanks, and other medical devices can be an obvious signal that the person has a disease. However, there are also many chronic illnesses that are invisible. An invisible illness means that a person can be continuously sick, but may look just fine on the outside. Most days, I get up in the morning and comb my hair. I pick out whatever best fits the description of something that could be both worn walking on the runway and survived unwrinkled while taking a nap. I slide on a little eyeliner, I zip up my boots, throw back about 7 or 8 pills, and proceed to my parking spot. I get in my average car, wiggle my handicap sign out from underneath the visor, and drop my gear into drive. It takes me a quick 15 minutes in traffic to get to the hospital. I reach blindly around my seat for the laminated parking pass that reads Infusion Center Patient Parking and throw it on my dashboard. I walk past the old, the sick, and the heavily pregnant. I see patients whose balding heads tell me that chemo has ravaged them. I slide into a recliner next to a very old man getting dialysis. I see the questions boiling up behind his eyes. Am I a volunteer? A caretaker? Didn't I know that these seats were reserved for patients? What's a girl like you doing in a place like this? He asks in a way that sounds more like an accusation than a question. Having two invisible diseases, primary immune deficiency disease and dysautonomia, makes me a prime target for suspicion. For most of my life, I dealt with doubtful teachers, coworkers, family, and doctors who challenged the idea that my condition was severe enough to inhibit parts of my daily life. But boy, did it. I had infections that lasted months, digestive issues, migraines, neuropathic pain, tachycardia, chronic fatigue, and hypersomnia. And that is just a few of the possible daily roadblocks. For years, I felt stuck between two worlds. I tried to keep myself looking calm and collected when I was feeling ill enough to be in the hospital. I remember sitting through business meetings with stomach cramps so bad that I soaked the back of my shirt entirely with sweat. I had already excused myself to go to the bathroom 3 times, and my clients were getting frustrated. By the time I could get back in my car to drive home, my mind was a total blank. I'd retained nothing from the meeting because of the distraction of the pain, which added a second level of humiliation on top of my jittery appearance. There seems to be an unwritten rule. As a professional, anyone can have a sick day from time to time, but you can't have 365 sick days in a row, and you can't expect every client to have patience and no prejudice in the face of invisible illness. I'm not covered in rashes or sporting a cast. My illness takes about as much shape as an Empire waist dress. My illness doesn't require a wheelchair full-time, but that doesn't make it any less present, constant, or by my side screaming like a toddler on meth that no one else can see. Here are just a few examples of scenarios that I experience in my daily life. Judgment over using handicap parking placards. I couldn't even stand in the line at the DMV long enough to get my paperwork done to get the placard. I had to grab a chair and keep scraping it across the floor. So as far as parking in between those blue and white lines, I'm not parking there because I'm lazy. I'm parking there because if I don't, my system is going to short wire, and I'm going to find myself in a situation where I end up passed out near the sidewalk with my skirt up over my head. Canceled parties, appointments, and dates. I don't cancel plans because I'm scatterbrained or reschedule my appointments because they aren't a priority. Issues with my health, like the state of my bowels, for instance, end up being the priority. Financial delusions of grandeur. I don't blink at that $25 copay because I can afford it 3 times a week. It's just going on the never-ending tab of medical debt. I have been through the valley of the shadow of debt. I have paced the hospital hallways looking for a diagnosis, a nurse, or maybe just a teaspoonful of that dignity that got spilled somewhere down the long line of colonoscopies. I have walked out of far too many doctor's offices, fuming, frustrated, and fogging up my car windows as I tried to settle my rattled body and mind around the concept that they say I might never have a diagnosis or a treatment, and in turn, a normal life. When you're sick, the search for that better life never really stops. No one can ever truly settle in their search for a healthier, more functional life. Accepting that life with chronic illness is going to be different than what you may have thought your life would be is a huge hurdle. But it doesn't mean you should stop constructing new ways to bring yourself a more satisfying quality of life. The blog. It has been hard for people in my life to grasp why I couldn't just let go of finding a diagnosis. They struggled to understand why I couldn't just take a pill or a shot and be cured. I started my blog, letsfeelbetter.com, to help those people in my life get the full story, if they were interested in hearing it. Not everyone in my family wanted to listen to what they felt like were excuses as to why my life was littered with doctor's appointments and hospitalizations. I was angry and heartbroken by the lack of support from my family. How family reacts to your disease is something we'll cover later in this book. It's a big issue, and one that hits hard for many. To my surprise, as I began to post my stories, people elected to read them. Although some members of my family opted to not read my blog, there was an outpouring of unexpected support from friends, neighbors, old teachers, and strangers. I received many personal emails from readers who were also going through the same issues I was experiencing. Readers checked in as I cataloged my daily life, trying out new medications and treatments and hitting my highs and lows of health. I wrote my horror stories, like the time I had a kidney infection and almost fainted in a discount grocery store because I was so determined to find kosher pie dough that I refused to leave. I wrote about being stuck in the hospital for 9 days and having to drink the colonoscopy prep solution every single night because my stomach was so paralyzed we couldn't get it to work. I wrote about my personal growth, too. I talked about signing up for cardiac rehab not long after my diagnosis and going from barely being able to sit up straight without blacking out to walking on the treadmill for an hour. I tracked how the changes in my lifestyle were starting to make an impact on my symptoms. I also shared the pain of every single relapse, rereading those posts about my worst moments and how I got back on my feet again took away so much of my fear. When I was having a low point, these posts reminded me that I would get back up again. It's my hope that this book will encourage you to also look back on your worst moments with humor and to look forward to your next relapse with strength. How this book can help you. This book will provide clarity in the chaos of chronic illness. Each chapter will assist you through different social, emotional, financial, and psychological issues associated with your disease. Here's what this book can help you to understand. Even before you can name your illness, it affects your life. The way we deal with symptoms before we have a name for them can greatly impact our self-esteem later on down the road. Maybe you thought you were weak or especially inept at handling life's up and downs. Understanding that you must acknowledge and accept what you can and can't push yourself to do will help to reconfigure the image you have of yourself. Know that there is a way to live with chronic illness. Life doesn't end after you become sick. Even if you've been knocked down by a bad flare, you will eventually get back up again and be able to learn new ways to cope with work, family, relationships, and stress. Throughout it all, it seems like everybody has an opinion. The disease may be yours and yours alone, but the people in your life will have their own thoughts and judgments about how you handle the impact of chronic illness on everything from your daily routine and medication choices to major life decisions. You'll have to decide whose opinion is worth listening to and whose you should be blocking out. Your disease does not disqualify you from love, career advancements, or a positive self-image. Once you begin to balance your perception of yourself with the reality of your disease, you'll be able to start making plans for your future. There are tools you can integrate into your life to help you alter your energy level, diminish the limitations of your disabilities, and increase your day-to-day stamina. We'll be discussing your treatment plan throughout the book, and you'll be asked to remember that your treatment is your choice. Chronic illness generally means a lifetime of complex medical decisions, from assistive devices to black box medication. You will find yourself at multiple forks in the road. You'll need to know your own priorities and strengthen your resolve so you can make educated choices with confidence. This book is not going to convert you to a new religion. It won't tell you which vitamins to take or what yoga positions to pretzel yourself into. You won't be force-fed a new dietary regimen or be prescribed a medication. It won't belittle your small triumphs or shame your momentary failures. This book is a reference for living, even when the world feels smaller every day. It is my hope that it will help you to understand that you are not alone in this battle, and that you are deserving of compassion, love, confidence, and true quality of life. Find answers to your questions. If the people in your social and emotional sphere of influence have proven to be unsupportive, or if you're still struggling with how to best describe what's happening to your body, you probably have a lot of questions you're itching to have answered. This book will help to answer the following and much more. How do you respond to people who call you a hypochondriac? How can you resolve the guilt from feeling like a burden in your marriage, relationship, or family? How do you explain your disease quickly without confusing or annoying people? How do you know which doctors and medications to trust? How are you supposed to get answers about what's wrong with you if you have no energy to make the diagnostic odyssey? Is this just a phase, or are we looking at a lifetime of chronic illness? How do you reach out for help? What does the world look like for someone with so much medical and emotional static? What is there to be done when your medical records could fill several binders, when you've been laughed out of doctor's offices, and when you feel as though no treatment will ever ease the realities of your disease? How can you push through when the medical debt builds up and the medications begin to create new symptoms you didn't see coming? How can you start the process of organizing the ridiculous mess that has become life with chronic illness? Who can you trust to guide you? Are you ready to get on with your life? For many years, other patients have contacted me through my blog who are totally consumed by their symptoms and unwilling to believe that happiness is out there for someone who can no longer support themselves physically, socially, and economically. They don't believe that there is anyone who can help them. But there is. There is always one person left to fight for your best life. You. Being a patient with ongoing needs, multiple medications, frequent hospital visits, and the responsibility of making life-altering choices about your own future health requires strength, smarts, persistence, and creativity. You'll need to be on top of everything all the time, even when you're under the weather. You'll need to be creative even when there seems only to be one path. You'll need to be strong, even when you're past your breaking point. You'll need to learn how to command help, even when you're alone. Chronic illness isn't something you beat or fight. It isn't a race or a lifelong quest to return to normalcy. You don't reverse, battle, or spar with it. Chronic illness is something you outsmart. And that's exactly what this book will help you do. Chapter 1. Accepting your life with chronic illness. Accepting that you even have a condition that could be termed a chronic illness is a hard first step to take. For me, it took 19 years of bad colds and frequent hospital visits to realize that maybe this wasn't a normal situation. Patients may feel reluctant to even consider the idea that they have a chronic illness, because they feel it puts them in a category that they don't want to be associated with. It's a long and lonely road to realizing you might need help, but there's certainly no way to outsmart something if you can't even introduce yourself to it. You may want to believe that you have a temporary condition, or you may expect to find a cure. While that may be true, it doesn't change the fact that until that day comes, you must find new ways to cope. Choosing to respond to each new crisis in your daily life in a comfortable and effective way doesn't mean you've given up on finding solutions to the overall problem. It simply means you're smart enough to want to suffer less. Acceptance isn't defeat. It's a declaration of self-respect under irrefutable circumstances. This is where you are, and you're going to make the best out of every moment of it. This book provides multiple tools to help you to lead a broader, more functional life. It's important to remember that chronic diseases are just as described. Chronic. They will come and go, but inevitably, you will relapse. Acceptance isn't about making you weak from the battle of fighting your disease. It's about building a smart and capable foundation from which a relapse can't knock you down. It's usually best to start with getting to know your disease intimately. The more information you have about your disease, the better equipped you'll be to handle the next move. This kind of information leads to empowerment, and that's what makes you a stronger, smarter patient. Where you once may have felt weak and powerless to your disease, your willingness to accept it and to learn its pattern, and your commitment to prepare for it, will bring you peace. Accept the challenges you are up against and welcome the opportunity to absolutely kick ass. Is a diagnosis everything you need? I've been living with a chronic illness since birth, and throughout my journey, I found myself twisted by embarrassment about my disease and shamed about being unable to lead a normal life. I've lost friends, been alienated by family, struggled to build a career, been blown off by doctors, and been thrown completely off course by misdiagnoses. I thought maybe all my confusion and exhaustion would be cleared away after I was finally diagnosed with a rare disease called primary immune deficiency in 2009, after 19 years of waiting for answers.
When I was also diagnosed with dysautonomia, the dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system.
It became clear that while a diagnosis gives you a definite lead in finding the right treatments, the right words don't always cure you. But having a diagnosis did make some powerfully positive impacts in my day-to-day life. Validation and proof. If you can find them, firm answers are good for your mental and physical health. Many chronic illnesses mimic each other. Finding out the exact illness you have puts you on a clearer path of treatment and can help you to find a more specific support group. This was a bittersweet moment for me. I had just been diagnosed with this crap disease, but at the same time, no one could tell me I was faking my disease anymore or blame my condition on me or my family. There was irrefutable proof that I had a disease. Invisible as it was a real thing, and the shame of being called a hypochondriac popped like a bubble. Research, prevention, and support. When you're diagnosed, you can do research on your disease and see specialists with more education about your disease. If you're diagnosed early, you may even be able to take preventative measures to eliminate common future problems for people with your disease. You also have access to drugs that are specifically for your disease. You can join disease-specific support groups, and you can connect with disease-specific organizations and online forums. After my first diagnosis, I had mildly successful rounds of treatment, but I was by no means cured. Also, having been undiagnosed for so long had created a dangerous issue with antibiotics. They were no longer strong enough to shake some of my infections. My doctors were perplexed about how to handle my treatment, and suddenly I found myself back in the game of being a hot potato, thrown from one specialist to another. Wasn't the diagnosis supposed to be everything? Wasn't the chance to go online and learn about what was happening to my body the ultimate goal? The truth is, yes and no. For every benefit that I spelled out earlier, there are some drawbacks. False hope. Once you receive a diagnosis, you may find yourself believing that your disease will now be immediately cured or go into remission. This isn't always the case, and keeping reasonable expectations is something you'll have to manage. If you receive a misdiagnosis of a more common disease, you may end up not getting the right treatment plan for you. And if the treatment plan fails, you could end up feeling more hopeless than ever. Misdiagnosis. Unfortunately, it's also possible you could receive a misdiagnosis. In a rare disease impact report published by Shire Pharmaceutical, the author stated that, according to patient caregiver respondents, in order to get a proper diagnosis, a patient typically visits up to 8 physicians, 4 primary care doctors, and 4 specialists, and receives 2 to 3 misdiagnoses before they are correctly diagnosed with a rare disease. A misdiagnosis can send a patient veering off into a series of unfortunate directions, wrong medications, dangerous unnecessary therapies, and personal turmoil are just a few of the potential outcomes. For example, they may be misdiagnosed with a mental illness and spend years trying to cure something autoimmune with verbal therapy, or they may be given an inaccurate diagnosis of a common disease when in fact their disease is rare. I went through my first 2 rounds of treatment waiting for the moment that the drugs would kick in and I would instantly feel better. I was hoping to wake up with a different body and a different life. But that doesn't always happen. Years after I was diagnosed with primary immune deficiency disease, and the full circle of my poor health became clear, I no longer held the false hope that a label necessarily meant a cure. In fact, I was now having to treat each pesky symptom one by one. Feelings after a diagnosis. You may think that a wave of sweet relief will overcome you after the moment you get diagnosed with something, even if it's only part of a puzzle piece. For me, the force that propelled me out of my bed the morning after my first treatment for my new diagnosis wasn't one of overwhelming gratitude. I was bone deep in resentment and outrage about all those years of doctor's visits, the hospital stays, the invasive tests, and the time wasted. I was angry about how much time I spent wondering whether I was crazy or not. I was surrounded by people who told me I was an idiot. And I felt like an idiot until most of my puzzle came together and I began to find the right doctors, do the right tests, and had a handful of names for the things that had plagued me all my life. Even after the words were there, so many of the answers and treatments weren't. I wanted my diagnosis to be my cure. I expected my body to change after it came to light. It had been this way for so many of my other friends. A diagnosis had meant a weekly steroidal shot or some kind of treatment, and then they continued on with their lives as if they had never been interrupted. Was my situation really so rare? How come I hadn't found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow? It's not as rare as you think. A few years after my first diagnosis, I began working for Global Genes, an international rare and genetic disease nonprofit. Serving as their managing editor brought me closer than most to the heart of what rare disease patients have to endure before they finally get their answers. Reviewing their stories, I found a few common themes. Family and friends felt that the disease wasn't real and that hospital visits were often unnecessary. Doctors regularly fobbed off concerns and requests for more tests and medications that were very new to the market. There was a real yearning for community support and communication both on and offline. Patients wanted to connect with other people who had gone through their same journey. As I edited, I realized that their stories were my story. My story was far from rare, and more likely than not, your disease is more common than you think. Chronic illness is everywhere, and the first thing to remember is that you are not alone. Make no mistake, the hunt for your diagnosis can be a lifelong one. If you've had active symptoms since birth, but have yet to be diagnosed with any recognizable disease, you may be one of the 350 million patients globally who have a rare disease. Whether you've been diagnosed with a classified disease, accepting the notion that you have a chronic illness is truly the first step in learning how to cope with your symptoms and the roadblocks they've erected in your life. You don't need a clear diagnosis to connect to a community of support. Many patients who have contacted me from my own blog have said they found comfort in my advice, but that they knew they had a long road ahead before they would be diagnosed. There was a sense of desperation in the tone of these emails. They didn't have a name for the symptoms that plagued them. All they had was suspicion and judgment from their families and friends and painful, boring, or humiliating tests from their doctors. What I wanted to get across to them was that they didn't need to wait for their results to connect to their community of support. It's those who are in the murkiest part of their pre-diagnosis that often need the most support. Growing up without a community of support, I often went through crises alone. I could only compare my life with chronic illness to the healthy people around me, and that made me feel completely inadequate in every way. Had I known others going through similar trials, I would have realized that my experiences were common and in many cases temporary. I felt that because I couldn't classify my disease, I had no right to support. No matter what stage of your disease, you are always entitled to support. Don't let the small details stop you from understanding and benefiting from the experiences of other patients who have been where you once were with an undiagnosed chronic illness. Acceptance is choosing to move forward. At what point in your life did you know that your body was different? That maybe it wasn't going to work as well as everyone else's? That it was going to require you to work harder, be more aware, and experience more pain and discomfort than those around you? Can you acknowledge that at some point, despite knowing all of that, you still chose to stay in this body despite its problems? You can take a minute to applaud how brave that is. You are among the few in this world who consciously know that they've got it harder but soldier on anyway. Can you take a moment to let go of the judgments of yourself and others, especially those times where you may have thought of yourself as weak or inept? Can you accept the idea that you are strong enough to live this life, whatever it throws at you? That you chose to live despite the handicap? That you know it won't be easy, but you're determined to be in the game anyways? Believe it or not, you are that person. You haven't given up. You may have made choices in the past that didn't pan out as you wanted. You may have had moments where you felt like giving up in whatever capacity that was for you, like taking painkillers to avoid pain, or showing fear when facing a surgery or test. But you're still here, in this body, because you chose to be in it every second of your day. On some level, you've already made peace with the chaos. What does acceptance really mean? Do you ever feel like you're constantly knotted up with the idea that you must hide your symptoms? Or you can't let your symptoms interfere with your work, school, or relationships? Are you unable to explain, accept, or even fully believe that your body can't always be as functional as your friends or coworkers? Do you ever get that feeling of unbearable shame when you cancel a night out or call in sick to work? Do you ever see other people at the gym doing more intense exercise routines, watch coworkers stay late, or look over your shoulder at all your friends still sitting at the bar while you head out on your way home? Do you think, why can't I be like them? You may feel like accepting your disease means that you're giving up being a better, healthier person. In your mind, you might be telling yourself, if I let go and accept that I have this disease, I'm going to become an invalid. I'm going to inconvenience everyone in my life. I'm going to lose my job and my relationship, and my children won't get the attention they need, and my life will be over. What if, instead of that conversation, this is the one you start having with yourself? I have a disease. I have a disadvantage here, and if I give myself the right emotional nourishment, internal and external support, information and education, time, patience, and acceptance, I can not only cope with my disease, I can be a functional person. I can be happy because I know that with everything I accomplish, not only did I carry it out under conditions that other people never had to overcome, but I achieved it without self-pity or contempt. I do have this disease, and every day it's making me stronger. Start considering the idea of accepting your disease. Take a moment and give yourself a break from the shame you've felt, the name-calling, and the frustration. You didn't ask for this illness, but you chose to live anyway. You may find yourself to be many things in this life, but at your core, you are a survivor. The long haul. Whether your disease turns out to be a rare or common one, you'll have to be prepared for a long haul. Treatment isn't always just a surgery or a pill. It is often continuous lifelong treatment, medication, or therapies. It can mean making vast changes in your lifestyle, reaffirming your life goals, and most importantly, taking on the responsibility of being a well-informed patient. Even though you may be looking for the right words to define your illness, your story will be a lot bigger than what is revealed in a single blood test, or even the entire unraveling of your genome. I wish I'd known that being diagnosed wasn't the answer to it all. It was the start of the question, how do I live now? Whether you're in your hospital bed, your office, at the park with your kids, or in the doctor's waiting room, the present moment is the time to start cultivating the attitude, perseverance, and knowledge of a prepared patient that accepts their circumstances. It's time to stare down the face of your disease and say, I know you, I hear you, and you can scream all you want, but I've still got a life to live. Chapter 2. Self-compassion and rising above self-defeating thoughts. Self-bullying is an unfortunate habit for those who are constantly trying to psych themselves up to deal with pain and other symptoms of their illness. You might have self-defeating thoughts, such as, don't be a wuss, it's just a headache. If everyone else has the flu and can still make it till clock out, my pathetic ass should too. I will not be the loser who cancels on her friends for the second night in a row. How we motivate ourselves changes the way we think about our character. If you judge yourself as weak or incompetent for having a flare-up, you make it impossible to cultivate the self-esteem that you need to deal with the reality that your disease will flare up. There are so many challenges to chronic illness. It will undoubtedly bring you through both physical and mental changes, weight changes, surgical scars, and other physical reminders of the disease will threaten your self-image and how others see you. But it all starts with how you see yourself. At 14, I'd gone from a size 00 to a 7 in the span of 2 months due to a new medication I was taking. One day, I was staring at my rear end in an end-of-the-aisle mirror at Marshall's. I said out loud, my ass is a continent. It could be worse, it could be a planet, my mother said, without sympathy, filing through a rack of dresses. I had already felt like a failure having to go on antidepressants to combat stomach pain that left me feeling like I was constantly trying to digest a sandwich full of shards of glass. Like most women with an illness, my weight was subject to whatever food my body could handle that day. Usually that meant toast and broth, but sometimes it was a slice of cake. It would also vary depending on the amount of exercise I could undertake at any given stage of illness. Sometimes I'd work out 3 times a week, and sometimes I could only work out once every 6 months. There were times that even walking from the bed to the bathroom was difficult. I was also constantly under the influence of the side effects of my medications. Steroids, a common treatment for those with autoimmune and immune deficiency diseases, usually resulted in what is petulantly referred to as moon face due to weight gain in the face. Over the next 10 years, my disease made it hard to eat nutritious meals or even wear a weather-appropriate wardrobe. I think the true test of my self-compassion was deciding to keep my Florida wardrobe, tank tops instead of turtlenecks, after doctors cut a slit above my breast for a porticath, placed there for my daily infusions. This meant that I had a huge, sticky bandage smack dab in the middle of my upper chest. It was visible through all my shirts, and without adopting a nun's wardrobe, there really wasn't an easy way to hide it. My body weight fluctuated so much that there was always the possibility that the jeans that fit on Tuesday would not fit again on Friday. As I had begun to accept my body's ever-changing shape, the panic that came with gaining weight eventually subsided. I did what I could, when I could, and I had to accept that some days there just wasn't the possibility of me going for a run or being able to eat a salad. Along the way, I developed my own set of tools, like exercises I could do from bed and meals I could make by triple pureeing them in a blender. Over time, you'll find the techniques that work for your body in its worst state. In the meantime, don't feel ashamed. Sick or healthy, your body will go through many periods of change. It's highly unlikely you'll remain the same weight as you were in high school. You'll develop scars, both surgical and unintentional, that will alter the landscape of your skin. When it comes to body confidence and the status of your disease, you will soon learn that the needs of your disease will come first. Sometimes that will mean eating a carb-heavy meal when you're trying to lose weight. Sometimes that will mean taking a few days off your exercise routine to let joints and tendons heal. It may not be ideal to have to curb your routine to your health needs, but ultimately, you are doing everything and anything you can for the betterment of your body. Shame. I'm sure you two have met. Chronic illness has a way of killing your assertiveness, stealing your self-esteem, and creating very large voids of depression that drain your confidence and mental fortitude. It's hungry, and it's ready to feed on your shame. But shame is not a chronic illness problem. It's a human problem. Dawn Wiggins, a licensed marriage and family therapist, who also happens to be a chronic illness patient herself, explains this concept of shame in relation to chronic illness. Shame can be sneaky. It tries to tell you that you are not good enough. My personal experience with a chronic illness allows for special empathy and compassion for those who experience chronic illnesses or pain. My own story is one of perseverance, insistence on hope, and reliance on a spiritual practice. Chronic pain, emotional or physical, can test patients and their families beyond measure, complicate their lives, and get in the way of reaching their goals educationally, socially, professionally, and mentally. I understand and can relate to the challenges of emotional and physical pain, and can instruct and empower patients who may feel their lives will never have a semblance of normalcy. Though it is easy to feel isolated in your shame, it does help to know that you are not the only one. I interviewed many invisible chronic illness sufferers for this book, and they all reported the intensity of shame. Sarah, a 23-year-old Crohn's disease patient, and Leanne, a 25-year-old chronic illness patient, both dealt with judgment from their families and peers. Sarah struggled to make friends who were unnerved by the idea of socializing with someone with a bowel disease. Leanne's family completely misunderstood her disease to the point that they wouldn't even let her hold her newborn nephew for fear that he would catch something or be dropped. I asked expert Dawn Wiggins about these cases and the millions like them, and she had some insight. When we become flooded with emotion, our logical brain has trouble working. The first step is to take a breath and assess our shameful thoughts. In a case like Leanne's, Wiggins says, new parents are riddled with fear and insecurity, and some parents cope with this fear better than others. The instruction to never hold the baby was meant to protect their child, not hurt their sibling. It's only human to feel shame when we receive negative social feedback. But this negative feeling doesn't mean that we are unworthy. It's just a feeling. The important thing to focus on is that you get to decide if this feeling is a fact. When overcome by shame, the best thing to do, according to Wiggins, is to take some deep breaths and think of someone you can call or something you can do, like taking a walk, coloring, or reading something inspirational to help bring you back to a more balanced place. To become an expert in the face of adversity, we must develop the understanding and belief that what other people think, say, and do stems from their own feelings and experiences and is not a commentary on our worthiness. The shame of invisible chronic illnesses. Okay, so we've cleared up the myth that shame is a solo experience. However, for patients like Sarah and Leanne, feeling excluded can be a huge shame trigger, especially when it's related to something we cannot control, like having a disease. For me, living in sunny Florida, my friends always want to hang out by the pool and have a few drinks. Unfortunately, I can't participate in these activities. My condition already creates a general constant dehydration for me, and humidity and alcohol exacerbate my symptoms. I found myself making up excuses that are everything but the truth. Feeling excluded from these hangouts is a bummer, but I've learned that I've just got to maneuver myself around them. Dinner afterwards, hangover resolving brunch the next day. There are also other shame triggers that can pop up with your invisible chronic illness. Trisha Holderman, now 50 years old, had her first ileostomy, a surgical operation in which a piece of the ileum is diverted to an artificial opening in the abdominal wall, at 24 years old, and found herself overwhelmingly self-conscious after her first surgery. I've had Crohn's disease for 30 years now. I will always have an ileostomy, as there is nothing to reattach my intestines to. I have had a total of 58 surgeries, including many resections, 5 hip replacements, many scars from feeding tubes, and, of course, this lovely bag on the side of my body. For patients with chronic illness like Trisha, there are a slew of things necessary for survival that can trigger shame. If your experience is anything like mine, you may soon be looking forward to devices like wheelchairs, walkers, canes, and having to use a motorized scooter in grocery stores, surgical scars, visual psoriasis, or other skin conditions, devices like colostomy and ostomy bags, drainage tubes, insulin pumps, ports, and PICC lines, epileptic helmets, tracheotomy tubes, and special shoes or stockings. While it might be less awkward to not have any of these devices, they are, most often, not optional. Most patients will wait until their absolute breaking point before getting on a grocery store's scooter or wearing any remotely revealing clothing that might expose scars or other signs of disease. They may think that people are staring or judging, or that they're abnormal or different. Self-defeating thoughts like these might begin to creep in. I know I thought all of the following more times than I can care to admit. I'll always be different from everyone else. People will always see my port tubes device before they look in my eyes. I'll never have the freedom that healthy people have. I'm not worthy of relationships when my disease means I can't contribute 100% of the time. It's important to begin the process of chasing away these self-defeating thoughts as soon as they come to you. overcome self-defeating thoughts. Feelings of depression can pull the light straight out of your world. In situations where your disease has made you feel humiliated, misunderstood, ridiculed, and abnormal, your thoughts may go right to the worst conclusions. If you start to catch yourself thinking some of the phrases above, try to reason with yourself. Don't validate absolute statements with reasoning. Always and never are not always the case. You are not always inconveniencing people. You are not never feeling well enough to see your friends. You may just be having a particularly bad flare-up. Remember who you really are. Why such a silly statement? Because when a disease feels like it's started to take over your body, you must consciously, forcefully, and repetitively remind yourself that you are still the person you were before disease. The disease is not all of what makes up your character. Remind yourself of your positive qualities. While other people's first impressions may misalign with what is true, it doesn't mean a chance to have a connection with them is ruined. There will always be time to change another person's perception of you. If you know who you are, communicating your truth with new people will come easily. Stand up for yourself. Stand up for yourself when someone tries to knock you down or makes you feel unworthy. However, the person you'll fight the most emotional battles with is you. You must be your own personal advocate. Don't be a bully to your own subconscious. Coping with body shame. Once you've been diagnosed with a serious disease, the relationship to your body can be profoundly altered. After discussing the topic of body shame with several patients and mental health professionals over the course of my illness, I learned that there are some coping mechanisms you can use to deal with your mindset around sudden or gradual physical changes. Kate Scalisi, a sex educator who works with chronic illness patients, provides some strategies for responding to the psychological impact of how chronic illness affects our bodies and how we feel about their worth during sickness. Focus on the positive. The first strategy she suggests is to begin by focusing on the things you do like about your body. This can be especially challenging for a population of patients who spend most of their days just trying to get their body's tantrums to quiet down long enough to get through one activity and on to the next. Start naming parts of your body that you're grateful for, not just aesthetics either. Can you eat today? Can you walk? Can you see clearly? Get naked. Get familiar with your body. It's a good rule to be aware enough of your body to know when serious changes have occurred. It's also useful to familiarize and get comfortable with your physical frame. Face the changes head on each day. Find your role models. Okay, so we can probably cross Tyra Banks off the list, but there are plenty of men and women whose bodies are beautiful even though they're not the norm. Find inspiration in the stories of patients running marathons to raise funds for their own treatment, wearing bathing suits in public despite having visual medical devices, and even going into careers as professional models for their unique and inspiring appeal. The key to body confidence for Scalisi is that you focus on all the things your body can do. The operative word is can. Scalisi says, perhaps you have gained weight, but still can inspire a room with your voice. Perhaps you're in a wheelchair, but the best cook on the block. Perhaps you have surgical scars or an ostomy bag, but you still teach your favorite fitness class. Such thinking helps put the changes you're experiencing, which can sometimes feel overwhelming, into perspective. Cultivating a new attitude away from shame. It can be difficult to learn to love the invisible and visible scars of your disease and not be ashamed of them and your body. Scars can be terrible reminders of the pain you experienced, but they can also be reminders of having overcome. After my first abdominal surgery, I would look down at my body in the bathtub and just cry. My scars had healed into raised keloid mounds, and there were just so many of them. I could never wear a bikini again. But over the next few months, as I experienced unimaginable relief from my surgery, I realized that my scars were a small price to pay to be able to eat, to have more energy, and to experience so much less pain than before. They became symbols of strength to me, and when it was time for the next surgery, I met my recovery with the confidence that any imperfection on the inside was worth whatever reflection on the outside. Although Travis Love, 30 years old, suffered from shameful thoughts about his chronic illness, he was also able to cultivate new ways of thinking about the scars of his disease. At 17 years old, he had two scars because of doctors failing to install a life-saving device on one side of his chest on their first try. "I have two scars and a bump where the port is now," explains Travis. "What's worse is that they installed one size larger, thinking that my body would grow into it, and it never did. But when they were implanting the port, they fixed the hernia, and I finally had a stomach to show off. I was tired of hiding. So most of that first summer, I walked around the house without a shirt, just getting used to the concept. Until one day, I answered the door without thinking about it." What sets Travis apart and makes him a great example of how we can fight back against our self-defeating thoughts is his attitude. As Khaleesi mentions, getting used to one's bare appearance can encourage approval about your body. This is not to say that Travis was never self-conscious about his body or port from then on, but his attitude of flexibility and non-judgment helped drive his decision about how he wanted to treat his body. To cover up one of the scars on his left chest muscle, he got a tattoo there and on his arm. He explains that these have been great talking pieces, as well as an easy distraction from his port when summer comes around, because they stand out quite a bit in contrast to my ghostly white skin. Travis has always had his positive attitude to fall back on. Admittedly, some of us don't, which can mean your self-esteem can sometimes take a beating. If this is the case, it's important to try and cultivate an attitude to combat these feelings. Know your limits. If your symptoms are flaring up, it might not be the time to vigorously exercise. Rest when you need it, even if you're worried you'll be judged as lazy. Know that change is inevitable. Even if you didn't have a chronic illness, you probably wouldn't have gone on to have a size zero wardrobe past puberty. We are always changing. Sometimes we even go back to the way we were before. Know that life goes on. You may now have to get around the grocery store in one of those scooters, but you still must pick up Pop-Tarts. Don't be embarrassed when you need to mobilize yourself in a new way. Know you're never alone. Man or woman, young or old, sick or well, we all have deep psychological scars. We are the only thinkers in our minds. What you think about yourself will dictate how much or little what others think affects you. Dawn Wiggins reminds us, we get to decide if our diagnosis is going to steal our joy, identity, determination, our compassion and empathy for others, and most importantly, our worthiness. It won't happen overnight, but making time and focusing on accepting your imperfections is as important as any other pill you'll have to swallow. Tell your story. Though it is important to seek the opinion and counsel of experts, in my research for this book, I heard several self-soothing ideas that helped to fight against the shame monster. Though I heard similar-sounding ideas from many others, Trisha summoned them up beautifully. One of the things that helped me the most was talking to young girls and women who were about to have the surgery I had. I realized how much better life and living were after the surgery. Telling your story in all forms, whether spoken as a mentor, written online, or communicated to a friend, can be a strong tool for healing and can help you make sense of some of the conflicting feelings you might have about your disease. Yes, you may have garnered some unwanted results. You may still feel separated from the norm.